From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, where we gather the highlights from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Guy Raz. This episode, why the fate of Obamacare has kept one Oregon bureaucrat up for years. Have you slept in the past 2 years?
Three times in the past two years. One was in February, I think, and then no.
Our cover story, the future of Obama's health care plan after the Supreme Court decides. Also, the unlikely rise and fall of a Louisiana congressman.
And here comes this little 5'2" Vietnamese-American, Joseph Gao, who is a Republican.
Mr. Gao goes to Washington, and later...
Where were you measured for this, bud?
My tailor, several row.
Bringing the sartorial styles of James Bond to the modern man, and the questions people ask TV survivalist Bear Grylls.
Do you want a pint of urine? And what does it feel like to eat horrible things? And do you have a death wish?
Plus, Steve Guttenberg writes his own Bible, actor Jared Harris on the movie he's seen a million times, and the strangest place pop singer Carly Rae Jepsen's heard her smash hit, Call Me Maybe.
We went to the strip club, believe it or not, and some girls got down and dirty to Call Me Maybe.
That's all on this episode of Weekends and All Things Considered. At some point this month, maybe next week, maybe even tomorrow, the Supreme Court will decide whether all or parts of the Affordable Care Act, the health care law backed by the White House, is constitutional or not. And for that reason, a man in Oregon named Rocky King isn't sleeping very well. Have you slept in the past 2 years?
Three times in the past two years. One was in February, I think. And then,
for the past 2 years, Rocky King's been Oregon's top administrator in charge of laying the groundwork for the Affordable Care Act. The law requires states to do things like set up online exchanges where insurance companies compete for business. And by January 1st, states are supposed to have a working model up and running. And for Rocky King and his small team...
You sleep, but what happens is you wake up in the middle of the night and you say, did you remember to talk to that person about composite versus tier rating in the group market? You wake up in the middle of the night saying, if they overturn, what are you going to do in terms of moving forward with your staff, the board, the legislature? So it isn't that you don't sleep. It's that there's an enormous amount of political, administrative, and just program kinds of issues you're constantly thinking about.
But there is a possibility that all the work you have done for the past 2 years will be for naught.
Yep, that is correct.
Our cover story today, the future of Obamacare, whether or not the High Court throws it out. The last time things got so complicated between the White House and the Supreme Court...
You really have to go all the way back to 1936 to find a year in which the court was ready to drop a major decision with major implications for the election right on the eve of that election.
That's Jeff Schessel. He's the author of the book Supreme Power, Franklin Roosevelt versus the Supreme Court.
If Franklin Roosevelt's first term began at a time of crisis for the country, his second begins at a time of crisis for the New Deal.
In his first 100 days in office in 1933, Roosevelt passed 15 pieces of landmark social legislation. Together, they came to be known as the New Deal. But within 2 years, the Supreme Court began to overturn some of those laws.
The court begins in 1935 to do what one Republican newspaper called throwing this revolutionary nonsense into the Potomac, where it belongs. The court really begins to essentially outlaw the New Deal.
And it led to a standoff between the White House and the court. And so weeks into his second term in 1937, Roosevelt tried to intimidate the justices. The plan was to expand the number of justices from 9 to 15. But the plan backfired. The public thought Roosevelt went too far. Jeff, this court packing scheme is widely considered by historians as a terrible mistake. So do you see parallels between the relationship that Roosevelt had with his court and the one that President Obama has with this court?
Absolutely. I think what President Obama is facing in this moment is what President Roosevelt faced, and indeed other progressive presidents have faced as well, and that is that you can get a whole lot done in the political arena. The two branches, the executive branch and the legislative branch, can work together and pass these big programs and make great progress, but ultimately there is no way to get around the fact that there is a third branch, and that on matters of the Constitution, and therefore on matters of policy, the judiciary has the final word. And presidential pressure on the Supreme Court can very well be counterproductive.
That's historian Jeff Schessel. So in the event the whole Affordable Care Act is thrown out, or parts of it are thrown out, like, say, the part that requires most uninsured Americans to buy health insurance, what's known as the individual mandate, is there a plan B? Well, the White House denies that there is. But according to NPR's health policy correspondent Julie Robner, if that does happen, it could lead to chaos overnight.
It could indeed be chaos overnight, and it's not just in the states. It could be chaos at the federal level. There is reason to believe, I've talked to experts, that the federal Medicare program would have no legal basis to continue paying any of its bills.
Wait, let's wind that back for a moment. We're talking about what's been known, what's been called Obamacare, we'll say, and the president has actually embraced this.
Yes,
this
he has.
You are talking about Medicare, something else. How is Medicare affected if the Affordable Care Act is thrown out by the court?
Every time Medicare puts out a regulation, a payment regulation to pay any kind of health care provider, they have to cite a legal authority. Since 2010, when this law passed, the legal authority that they have cited has been the Affordable Care Act. So, yes. And remember, Medicare pays about 40% of the nation's hospital bills.
Yeah.
So you could have an awful lot of hospitals who wouldn't be getting paid for a period of time, which could affect not just Medicare beneficiaries, but everybody else who goes to those hospitals. You could have hundreds of thousands of doctors who wouldn't be getting paid for some period of time. Congress would clearly have to come back in and do something about that.
Julie, do we have a sense of how many Americans have been covered under this provision that allows folks under 26 years to be covered by their parents?
The Census Bureau projects that it's about 2.5 million. There have been other studies that suggest that it could be considerably more than that. And I think it's been by far the most popular provision. In fact, it's one that Republicans are arguing amongst themselves that if the law were to be struck down, that might might be one that they want to put back.
Yeah, presumably that would cause a lot of chaos for younger folks who may not have insurance for their companies but who are insured under their parents' plan. Overnight, they would no longer be covered.
Yeah, although it might not be overnight, because remember, it took a while to get them covered because they had to be added through the contracts, the insurance contracts. So it might actually take a little while to un-add them, if you will. There might be other lots of dislocation. That might not be such an immediate dislocation.
We keep hearing about exchanges, these exchanges that would essentially be a marketplace, and they'd be state by state, and all these insurance companies could compete. The idea would be that you'd get a great deal because, like with car insurance, all these companies would be competing for our business, and then you would get a better deal. Those could still happen, right?
Well, it depends. I mean, it depends what the court does. If the court were to take down the entire law, the states could come back and enact their own laws to have exchanges. Remember, Utah already has an exchange. Mm-hmm. Massachusetts, under then-Governor Romney, has an exchange. If the court took it down and states wanted to come back and do their own, that's a possibility.
I mean, even without a mandate, and even if the whole deal is thrown out, couldn't you have an exchange that could still offer pretty competitive rates, even if there was no mandate? Couldn't that work in theory?
There's definitely an argument, and we've seen this over the years, about the idea of simply having, rather than individuals going out and buying on their own and small businesses buying on their own, it makes more sense to have a marketplace, if you will, where they can go and have people come together in groups. The problem in health insurance, however, is that you then have the offsetting problem of people with pre-existing conditions. And that's, again, what will be a real issue if the court is to strike this down. What do you do about people with pre-existing conditions? The trade-off here was that the mandate what makes it viable for the insurance industry to cover with people with pre-existing conditions, because they'll have that many more healthy people to offset the cost. If you're not going to have that many more healthy people, are they going to be able to offset the cost? And that's going to be the big question.
That's NPR's health policy correspondent Julie Robner. So what about the idea that Medicare could face a serious challenge if the law were overturned? We asked Tom Miller, a healthcare economist at the American Enterprise Institute, about that.
I don't think so. I think that's assuming a degree of retroactive application, which would not be practical. But in the short term, you're not going to roll back what's already been done in Medicare. So that's not going to create some type of instant crisis. We got a long-term crisis in Medicare, but it wouldn't be a problem the next year or so.
Now, all of these states, as we've been hearing, or many of these states, with the exception of states that are challenging, that have mm-hmm. challenged the Affordable Care Act, have actually earnestly been laying the groundwork to prepare their states for what they will have to do, setting up the exchanges and all these new provisions that they will have to implement. We just heard from Oregon, from someone in Oregon. He's saying this is going to be a nightmare if this is thrown out, because he's spent the past 2 years doing all this stuff.
Well, they're quite enthusiastic about doing a lot of things in Oregon. And they have other ideas to expand
upon. But there are other states, too.
About a dozen to 15 states have been more enthusiastic, or at least we're going to work with this and make it come about.
Yeah.
As you know, you can find about another two dozen states which are very much either flat out opposed to this or keeping their powder dry.
Or they haven't done much.
They haven't done much. Mm-hmm.
Of course, if the Affordable Care Act is upheld, the states that have not laid the groundwork, have, you know, as you say, kept their powder dry, they may miss these deadlines, right?
Well, the deadlines are going to be missed anyway, but that would be more explicit missing of the deadlines.
Is that going to be a problem?
I think that if the administration remains in office in a second term, they will try to implement what would be more of a federally orchestrated replacement for the states that have not acted.
And so you're saying it's not going to be chaos?
Well, I think the chaos is actually that the exchanges aren't going to be ready for prime time on the date allowed in any case. So all of that would be part of what would be rethought in the event that first the law was overturned, secondly that you had a change in the balance of forces on Capitol Hill and in the White House. This bill barely got through with a 60-vote margin for hell or high water in the Senate, but it went past what the American people were actually ready to digest and support.
Do you have a plan, Tom, from AEI, that you think congressional Republicans could back?
Possible. I'll be coming out in about 2 weeks, so I certainly have that. You know, that's speculative, because what congressional Republicans might be ready to do in the near term, first, it depends on the scenario they're in. If the law is not overturned at all, they're going to be locked in on, well, we're once again going to run up the hill to suggest how we would repeal this and many other provisions. In the event that the law is totally overturned, the pressure's on them to produce at least the framework of saying this is what we're campaigning on for this fall and what perhaps a new president would be ready to go with in early that year. I think that the idea that you're going to have some type of replay of, say, what the Clintons did in 1900, here's my 1400 pages, or here, you're not going to see that. You have to be able to go to the public with some things they can understand in terms of broad principles and a framework for where they're going to go.
One of the things congressional Republicans complained about was how big the Affordable Care Act was, 7,000, 8,000 pages.
Yep.
Is your plan, you know, a one-page PDF?
No. Well, you always have to have the one-page executive summary. Otherwise, no one will pay attention to it. But then you end up explaining underneath it as to what the other
lots
things
of footnotes. Are.
We should all like to think that we could solve healthcare with a one-page PDF, but that would also be very unwise.
Well, Tom Miller, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Tom Miller, by the way, also wrote a Supreme Court brief in support of overturning the Affordable Care Act. Well, here in Washington, there are very few examples of Mr. Smiths, the fictional character played by Jimmy Stewart in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
I don't think I'm going to be much help to you down there in Washington, son. I'll do my best.
The story, of course, is about a hapless young man sent to the Capitol to do the bidding of special interests, but who eventually decides to put principles over politics. Well, the filmmaker Leo Chang saw a similarity between that story and the one of a modern-day Louisiana lawmaker named An Joseph Gao. And Chang decided to chronicle Gao's rise and fall in a documentary called Mr. Gao Goes to Washington. In 2009, Joseph Gao became the first Vietnamese-American elected to Congress. Gao was a Republican elected in a majority Democratic and African-American district. Voters in that district decided to give Gao a chance after the incumbent William Jefferson was caught up in a major scandal.
They found $90,000 in cash in his freezer in pie tins and boxes. It was basically the biggest scandal, perhaps, in congressional history.
Bribery.
Cold, hard cash, investigators say, wrapped in foil in Tupperware containers.
There are two sides to every story.
In 2008, he ran again, hoping to get reelected. He had won a Democratic primary that had a very strong field. And he thought that was it. You know, he's got another term in the bag. This is New Orleans we're talking about, which is 65% African-American, 75% Democratic. If Bill Jefferson was able to win the Democratic primary, he should just...
That's it. He's going to win.
His seat.
That's
exactly.
The election.
And here comes this little 5'2" Vietnamese-American, Joseph Gao, who is a Republican, and he decides that he was going to run for Congress. Doesn't matter that nobody knows who he was, and he went for it.
This is a man who is Joseph Gao. He's a lawyer by training. He originally studied to become a priest, and you talk about that in the film. We know Joseph Gao went off to win. He pulled off an incredible upset.
What an accomplishment for this immigrant from Vietnam, a survivor of the fall of Saigon, now
congressman-elect.
Leo Cheng, how did he win?
He campaigned on the platform of, ironically, change. He was selling himself to the district as a change agent, much like the President Obama was doing to this district that has been long plagued by corruption and lots of dirty politics.
So what's amazing when you watch this film is what a nice guy he comes across as, a really genuinely nice person, almost to the point of naivete. There's a clip in there where he's at a Vietnamese-American celebration, and he's chatting with a constituent. He says, listen, party labels, Democrat, Republican, they're just, you know, they're something like, they're just labels. They don't really mean anything.
You and I, political affiliations, it's only for convenience. It's nothing else.
Perhaps having been a seminarian, perhaps having been a very religious man all his life, he really believed that, you know, certain things should work a certain way, and he really believed that the American government should be bipartisan, should be full of compromises, should be able to do service for the people. And he, little Joseph Gao, was going to come and make that happen.
Gao comes to national attention a few months after he arrives to Washington. He becomes the only Republican to support the health care legislation that was introduced by House Democrats in 2009.
One lone Republican broke ranks. That was Joe Gao of Louisiana.
One got away. Congressman Joseph Gao.
He was obviously elected as a Republican. It was sharply criticized by the Republican leadership. But, I mean, he felt like he had to do this.
You know, he wanted to vote for the health care reform because he really believed that his district needed it. It is one of the poorest district in the country, and 4 short years prior to that vote, Hurricane Katrina devastated that district. Now, some might argue that this is also an extremely smart political calculation on his part, right? What better way to appease a majority Democratic district that's also majority African-American by voting for a huge Democratic legislature agreeing with the president.
So he votes in support of this legislation, but then, of course, it comes back to the House after the Senate passes its own version, and then it becomes really the final vote. And Gao, at that point, says, I'm not going to back it this time around. What happens?
From Joseph's point of view, there was not sufficient protection or sufficient language that prevents federal funding of abortion, and that was the reason that he ultimately decided against voting for the final bill.
When he ultimately did decide to vote against it, it upset many, many people in his constituency.
He has the support of white-moneyed conservative Republicans who do not share the same worldview as African-Americans do. He should have voted with the president on health care.
I mean, he had some fairly liberal positions, or positions one could argue were somewhat liberal on things like climate change.
Exactly. I mean, he is pro-immigration reform. Right. He was one of the co-sponsors for the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Right. He also backed the DREAM Act. I mean, these are issues that very few Republicans support.
My theory is that as a young man, religion was something that gave him comfort, and he really believed in what the church says about abortion, and it became his most important personal principles.
As he sort of gets closer to his to the date of the re-election, it's clear that he is not going to defeat his main rival, Cedric Richmond, the Democrat. Gao does something unusual and something he didn't do in his first campaign. He goes negative.
His law license was suspended for perjury. He has been arrested for fighting in a bar, fined by the state's ethics committee. So the whole issue here of honesty is in question if you are talking about Cedric Richmond.
I'm sure that Mr. Gao is not criticizing me for defending myself against a drunk bigot who used the N-word and then put his hands on me.
Did you lie to the people about where you live?
You get the sense watching the film that Gao was not comfortable going negative. He didn't like doing this. Why do you think he went negative?
The negative campaigning in his reelection campaign, I believe, was a bit of a desperation measure. I mean, you know, the president, which this community overwhelmingly support, has picked his opponent over him, even though he's been out, you know, trumping his relationship with the president. There was not a whole lot that they could do if they kept pursuing this narrative of him being this man of principle that was going to be best for the district.
After he lost to Cedric Richmond, is he still interested in politics? Do you think he'll go back to it?
I believe so. I mean, I think that, you know, I mean, he's still very young, and in some ways, this is just the first chapter of his political story. He is definitely very involved still with a lot of the political causes. I know that he's been traveling around the country with a Vietnamese-American PAC that they were raising money. They're really trying to support Vietnamese-American candidates from around the country. And him, you know, being the pioneer politician, you know, in the Vietnamese-American community, I don't think we've seen the last of Joseph Gao yet in the political world.
That's Leo Chang. He's the director of the new documentary, Mr. Gao Goes to Washington. And it'll air across the country later this year on PBS stations. You can find out more about the film at MrGaoFilm.com. Leo Chang, thank you so much.
Thank you, Guy.
Fifty years ago, a film franchise ushered in a new era of action, adventure, and, of course, style. James Bond. Men wanted to look like him, and women also wanted men to look like him.
Am I properly dressed for the occasion?
Quite suitable.
His manner, debonair. His suits, impeccable.
Where were you measured for this, bud?
My tailor, Savile Row.
Well, as it turns out, the actors playing James Bond have never been outfitted by Savile Row tailors. The first Bond tailor was located just off Savile Row at a place named for its founder, Antony Sinclair Limited. And the current managing director there is bringing back the early James Bond fashions for the modern man. His name? Mason. David Mason.
A lot of our clients are demanding replicas of those original suits.
Shocking.
Antony Sinclair Limited is a bespoke tailoring business.
You would probably understand better as custom.
And back in the 1950s, the shop had a number of former British Army officers as clients, one of them being the director of the first Bond film, Terence Young.
Part of his job was to knock a young Scotsman into shape and prepare him for the role.
Sean Connery was hardly the suave, debonair type at the time. He was a former bodybuilder, so Connery felt more comfortable in T-shirts than tailored suits.
He taught him how to talk, how to walk, how to eat, what to drink, and the icing on the cake was the bespoke finery. He was a huge man, his 46-inch chest, 33-inch waist, so there was an extraordinary drop, which makes it quite a challenge to tailor an elegant suit.
But what Sinclair created ended up becoming hugely influential. Out went the heavy fabrics and boxy cuts favored by well-dressed Englishmen of the time, and in came lightweight fabrics fitted and tailored. That's because Bond creator Ian Fleming had spent a great deal of time in Jamaica.
And for his hero, who could be deployed to an exotic location at a moment's notice, he needed go-anywhere-do-anything clothing.
And that's just what happened in the first James Bond film, 1962's Dr. No.
The first thing that you ever see of Bond is not his face or his body. You see his hands. He's dealing cards in the casino, playing baccarat. And you see a beautiful silk turn-back cuff on the sleeve of his midnight blue evening suit.
I need another 1,000.
Then you see a reverse angle shot, you see the shawl collar, and it is not until his opponent in the game asks who the check should be made payable to that he answers,
Bond. James Bond.
And then you see his face for the first time and the full evening suit, which became, of course, the definitive look for all James Bonds since that opening moment.
What has been your favorite Bond suit of all time?
Without question, most people's favorite, and mine, is the three-piece Prince of Wales suit that he wore in
Goldfinger.
Killer suit, absolutely fantastic. And the way it was introduced in the film was very special. He just recovered from sedation aboard Goldfinger's private jet.
Oh, that explains the humming.
And he was unshaven.
I would like to arrive more appropriately dressed.
And he went to the bathroom to shave and to change, and he emerged wearing this magnificent piece of work.
You like close shaves, don't you?
David Mason has now reproduced those suits from Goldfinger and Dr. No for a new Bond exhibit at the Barbican. It's an art center in London, and he's even willing to make one for you and me.
A bespoke suit would run in your currency at $5,000 plus.
Okay, maybe not for us. But if you really want to dress like James Bond, David Mason is at your service. Do your suits come with, you know, like cuffling darts or dagger shoes or any poisonous things embedded in them?
No, but it could be arranged. We've not had any requests yet.
You could arrange that.
Of course.
Survival expert Bear Grylls has been a nearly inescapable presence on the Discovery Channel for many years.
My name is Bear Grylls. I've served with the British Special Forces. I've climbed to the summit of Everest and crossed the frozen oceans of the Arctic.
His show Man vs. Wild drops the ex-British Special Forces soldier into some of the world's most hostile environments.
Now, I'm in the French Alps. Now, I'm in Iceland. Now, I'm in the Sierra Nevada mountains.
The truth is textbook survival. It tells you to stay put, stop, wait for rescue, don't take any risks. But there'd been a host of kind of survival shows like that, and I didn't really want to do that. I thought, if I'm going to do TV, I want to do the stuff that I love doing. And, you know, if you've got to get down this waterfall and all you've got is your shoelace and this vine, this is a cool way you can improvise a harness and do this, and let's get on and do it.
I'm going to paraglide into this wilderness. A camera crew will follow me.
The show peaked as the number one cable program in the country with a global audience of millions. But in March, Bear Grylls and the Discovery Channel parted ways. He's currently taking a break from television, spending more time with his kids, and developing new ideas for a return to TV in the U.S. And in the interim, he's written a memoir. I spoke to him about his life, his childhood, and how he got his name.
Well, I was christened Edward, and then my sister, at about a minute old, said it's the most boring name in the world. I'm not going to have a brother, having waited so long for a brother called that. So that became Teddy, and then Teddy Bear pretty quickly. So.
And on the show, Bear Grylls is anything but boring. A warning now, though. If you're squeamish, you may want to tune out for the next 30 seconds or so.
In northern Mexico, I was walking through the sand dunes on the edge of the Laguna Salada salt pan.
One of the most memorable moments on Man vs. Wild was now a famous scene where...
I need a pee, and I don't want to waste that, so what I'm going to do...
You had a snakeskin around your neck.
Used a snakeskin.
You stored your own urine in that snakeskin and then drank it.
And I'm not expecting this to be particularly appetizing. I'm all for cocktails, but snake in heads and pee.
Difficult watching you do it.
It's funny to become known for things like that. You know, those sort of moments aren't particularly fun, whether you're drinking the fluid from an elephant dung or camel intestinal fluids or yak eyeballs or drinking your own pee. It's all going to be... I think viewers quite like it when I'm suffering or eating or drinking something horrible or really up against it in some... you know, quicksand or whatever. I've definitely learned that those are the viewers' favourite moments. My favourite moments where it's all going swimmingly, the sun's out and I've got a fire going and a nice snake on the barbecue.
I want to ask you about how you got there, because you essentially, for years on television, put yourself in positions where most people would not live, would not be able to live through it, would not survive. And yet you seem to crave it, you need it. Can you explain why?
Well, I think it's more that I love it. You know, from a young age, I was climbed with my dad when I was about 5 or 6. And at that age, it was the same deal. I didn't necessarily like being cold and scared up a rock face, but I loved hanging out with my dad. And I think I developed a belief that, the wild brings people together. And I always loved that. I love the small team we film with. If I look at Man vs. Wild, we've had the same small crew of 4 of us for 7 seasons of the show. And they're best buddies. And I have the same dynamic with them that I had with my small team of SAS soldiers when I served with the British Special Forces. You know, you're in difficult places, you're under pressure, but you need to look after each other and you create real strong bonds. And that's always been my draw to the wild, I think.
Bear, after you finished school, you decided to join the military. You actually went into the British Special Forces, the famed SAS. I mean, you describe this camaraderie that you found there. Did you know that was what you were looking for?
Well, I think my dad had been a Royal Marine Commando, and, you know, I always loved that in him when I was growing up. I was always pretty amazed, you know, but every boy wants to do one step better. And, you know, the SAS was, I suppose, always the pinnacle. And I think it gave me at a young age a confidence that I didn't necessarily have. And you know, obviously it gave me a lot of the skills that I've gone on to use. But it also gave me some of the best friends in my life. And I look back on those days and, you know, they were definitely hard work, but a real kind of sense of pride at a young age that it gave me that I'm super grateful for.
I was curious about part four of your book. It's called Faith, which is not something unusual to find in a book written by an American, but less common in Britain. I mean, in your country, people don't openly talk about faith, admittedly, as they do here in the U.S. How much a part of your life does faith play?
Well, you're right. Faith is personal, if it's to be real, and I think things that are personal are sometimes hard to talk about, and I think Brits are especially bad at that. But, you know, I've definitely learned also over my life through a lot of difficult times, through, you know, whether it's military stuff or losing people on big expeditions on high mountains. And, you know, I've definitely learned it takes a proud man to say he never needs any help. I'm not that man. I do need some help sometimes. And my faith has been that to me. It's been a real, like, quiet strength and a real glue to our family, I think, as well. For me to be able to climb big mountains with a person I feel has made these mountains has been a huge privilege. And it's a real, as I said, like a backbone that's run through a lot of these adventures in my life.
I have to mention, Bear, that the show did come under fire a couple years ago after some reports that elements of the show were staged, right? That you had stayed in hotels and there were receipts. And you actually addressed this in the book. What was that about? What happened?
Well, I think, you know, any show, when it starts to do well, you know, you get the odd missile sent your way. You know, I think I've definitely made mistakes, you know, and I wrote pretty honestly in the book about one night where I sneaked back to my family. I'd been away for a few months and I was filming somewhere near the UK, and they came, I finished production a day early and just sneaked out to see them. And that became a whole big story. And, you know, I think sometimes you look back and you think, you know, I so would have done things differently. And I think the best response is to quietly just get on and do your job and do it well, and try and sort of, you know, have humility about that. And the job for me was always about trying to empower people through what we do.
I remember when I would spend, you know, months at a time in a place like Iraq or Afghanistan as a reporter, the first thing I would want when I would return to the U.S. was a hamburger at In-N-Out Burger. What's the first thing that you want when you're back in civilization?
The real struggle for me, if I'm honest, is being away from my family a lot. And yeah. I've got three young, wonderful young boys. I try and kind of remind myself a lot of my soldier friends are away for proper lengths of time, you know, 9 months at a time. And, you know, I'm only going away for a few weeks here, a few weeks there. But over 7 years, it's been a lot of time abroad filming. And, you know, I love it. I was in last night, I just got back and in a bath with the three boys, lots of bubbles, lots of rubber ducks. And Shara going, "Gosh, all these people could know how ridiculous you really are." And I'm thinking, but you know what? This is just heaven.
Yeah, you have. I mean, your wife is just completely outnumbered.
Well, somebody said to me the other day, you've got to wear tighter underpants. That's the key to getting a girl, apparently. So there you go. It's another good survival tip for you.
Would you ever encourage any of your young sons to do what you do?
Yeah, you know, they love adventure. My dad always used to say to me, you got to follow your dreams and look after your friends along the way. And I try and say the same things to them. Their mum says, but it can't involve a 1 in 6 chance of not coming home like Everest does. But they've got way more brain cells than me. They're going to do something much more important, I think.
That's Bear Grylls. His new autobiography is called Mud, Sweat, and Tears. He was the host of Man vs. Wild, which aired here in the U.S. on the Discovery Channel for 7 years. Bear, thank you so much.
No, pleasure. Thank you.
When Steve Guttenberg was 16, he went to see an agent about starting an acting career. The agent told him, "You are the last guy I would pick to be a movie star." But despite that, Steve Guttenberg still decided to become an actor. And he's written about his journey in a new book. It's called, what else? The Guttenberg Bible. And it starts like this. The summer before Guttenberg was supposed to head off to college, he moved from Long Island to L.A. to try his luck at acting.
And within a few days, I started staking out Paramount Studios and 20th and Universal. And in those days, there was no computer, there were no cell phones, and there was just a guard with a telephone. So I started walking by the time punch machine, and I punched a blank card like everybody else was punching their cards, and I started sneaking onto the lot. And I found myself an office, and I went to the prop department, and I said, "I need tables, chairs, a desk for Happy Days." And he asked me a couple questions. I said, look, Gary Marshall needs him right now. If you want to call Gary Marshall's office, great. And he said, you know what? I don't want to call Gary Marshall's office. I just want to give you this furniture. So I brought it up to my office, and I had my phone, and I started making my own phone calls.
That's unbelievable. And nobody suspected this.
No, it was actually an empty building. I had the office for 2 years. And my real angel was a very, very important casting director named Hoyt Bowers. I would call his assistant, his secretary, and say that Mork and Mindy need something, and she would run out, and the office would be empty, and I'd walk into Mr. Bauer's office, and I'd say, hi, I'm the Gucci of young actors, but I'm stuck on a shelf in a drugstore, and I can't get anywhere. And I did that 3 or 4 or 5, 6 times, and finally, he said, look, if you promise me you'll never come back, I actually was on top of his desk tap dancing. He said, if you never come back, I will give you 5 minutes. He ended up giving me about a half an hour. He called a wonderful casting director named Fran Bascom over at MTM. He sent me over there, and I got my first television movie, which was called Something for Joey. But I had a bunch of people in Hollywood that had a big heart, and they understood what it was like to be a beginner and gave me a little bit of a leg up. And God bless Hoyt Bowers for not throwing me out that seventh time.
The first film I remember seeing you in was The Boys from Brazil. You had a pretty significant role. You die early on in the film. But you're this kid in Paraguay who discovers Nazi war criminals. In that film, you worked alongside Laurence Olivier and Gregory Peck. And here you are, this kid, barely at a high school. What was that like?
And also there was James Mason.
James Mason, indeed, yeah.
It was fantastic. It was my first trip overseas. It was my first trip on a big-time airplane. First time I had stayed in a hotel. It was just incredible. And I remember in a dinner I had with Olivier, Greg Peck, Mason, and Frank Schaffner, the director, who did one of my favorite movies with Planet of the Apes. They were all talking about the script, and I had one thing to say, and I said, excuse me, Mr. Schaffner, but there's this one part here where Larry, and Olivier asked everybody to call him Larry, so where Larry has this sort of monologue, and I don't think the point really will come across. And the table got quiet. And Mason smiled and Peck smiled. And Olivier was just so self-effacing, he didn't say anything. And Schaffner looked at me and said, young man, the greatest living actor in the world is saying those words. The point will come across. And I just shut my yap for the entire dinner. And, you know, I always find the more successful the actor, the nicer they are, the sweeter they are. And these three guys, these monsters, were just fantastic to me.
Your first sort of huge breakout role, of course, was in Diner, in the 1982 film by Barry Levinson. That movie, of course, is set in Baltimore in the late 50s. It launches the careers, it launches your career, Mickey Rourke, Paul Reiser, Kevin Bacon, many other actors. What do you remember about working on that film?
Well, I remember our first meeting in a hotel room in a Holiday Inn where all the cast was waiting for the last guy to come in, who was Mickey. And Mickey came in with a white silk scarf, and we all looked at each other and said, what the heck is this guy doing? And Mickey and I became good friends. And actually, one time Mickey and I wanted to do a scene together. We came to Barry, asked him, because we were the only guys who didn't have a scene together. And Barry went away for about 10 minutes and wrote the technically I'm a virgin scene. About 20 minutes later, we went and shot it. I had a great time. Everybody was so hungry and competitive and generous at the same time. And Ellen Barkin and Kevin Bacon and Paul Reiser,
yeah.
Tim Daly and Danny Stern, Mickey. I got so lucky to be in that film. Just so lucky.
You became quite well known for a recurring role as Cadet Kerry Mahoney in Police Academy. That franchise became a huge hit. The sixth, I didn't realize this until I read the book, the sixth biggest grossing film in the U.S. that year, 1984, $146 million. Even went to the Cannes Film Festival. That movie must have changed your life and your career.
The film was a huge success. And I remember sitting with my manager watching the screening. He turned to me and said, this is the biggest piece of junk I've ever seen. And we're putting you in television series tomorrow. And then Police Academy came out. And I remember the producer called me that next morning and said, I'm a millionaire, I'm a millionaire. And I didn't know what a box office was. I didn't know what grosses were. But I sure did learn pretty quickly that that's a very, very important part of Hollywood, is making money. And I was very lucky to be in that movie and others that have made money and bought a lot of beach houses for a lot of producers.
Your career, obviously, as you make clear in this book, has had its high periods and its low periods. But your name has always seemed to stay in the spotlight.
Yes, I've been very, very fortunate that, first of all the movies that I've made always play on television or on cable. So the public gets to see me often, and that's very, very important for an actor, to keep a bit of visibility, because the chances of becoming a film actor are one in a zillion, and I've been very, very fortunate.
That's Steve Guttenberg. He's best known for his roles in Diner, Three Men and a Baby, and the Police Academy series. His new memoir is called The Guttenberg Bible. Steve Guttenberg, it was great having you on. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. This has been a great pleasure, and one of my dreams come true, really, to be on NPR.
All summer long, we're asking filmmakers, actors, writers, directors, about the movies that they never get tired of, the ones they could watch a million times, including this one from the actor who plays Lane Price in the hit TV show Mad Men.
My name is Jared Harris. I am an actor, and the film that I've seen a million times and would like to sit through a million more is Tootsie, directed by Sidney Pollack, starring Dustin Hoffman, Jessica Lange, Terry Garr, Bill Murray, George Gaines, who's one of my favourite characters in the whole film. He plays John Van Horn. I saw it when I was at college at Duke University. I remember very clearly going to see it. I was a budding actor myself, and it was inspiring in many ways. You know, that opening sequence of the film where you see Michael teaching his students, the concentration and the seriousness with which they take it was inspiring.
Come on, no, 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 keep looking.
You know, he's an actor who is so difficult to work with because he's such a perfectionist.
You've got one of the worst reputations in this town, Michael. Nobody will hire you. I can't even send you up for a commercial. You played a tomato for 30 seconds. They went a half a day over schedule because you wouldn't sit down.
Yes, it wasn't logical.
You were a tomato!
He can only get a job playing a woman. So he dresses up as a woman and gets a job on a soap opera to raise money for a play that he and his roommate, played by Bill Murray, want to put on.
Say something.
How do you do, Jeff? It's nice to meet you.
You look very nice. Nice.
But here's not right.
No, it's kind of high. You got kind of a Howard Johnson thing going on.
Well, do something. I can't be late my first day. Come on. Easy, easy.
Well, it works.
But what?
Don't play hard to get.
Dustin Hoffman's performance in the movie as Michael Dorsey and as Dorothy Michaels is funny and it's moving, and there are times when you forget that he is Michael Dorsey and you get completely involved in the character that he's created.
I'm afraid, Dr. Booster, that you have underestimated me. If you want to win me over, you'll have to deal with my mind and not my lips.
Got it.
My favorite scene in the movie, wow. There's a scene later on in the story where John Van Horn shows up to try and seduce her, and she won't let him in to his apartment, and he starts serenading her from the street, singing, you know, in his baritone.
I'll know then and there.
I'll know when my love comes. And she has to let him in because he's making such a scene. And there's this really funny scene where he basically tries to sort of force himself on her.
Dorothy.
Yes.
I want you.
I beg your pardon.
I've never wanted a woman this much.
Oh, please, John, please. Perhaps.
And Bill Murray arrives just in the nick of time and saves Dustin from the clutches of John Van Horn's ardor.
Jeff Slater, John Van Horn.
How do you do? How do you do?
Gee, I hope I haven't...
No, I hope I haven't. I want you to know for the record, Jeff, that nothing happened here tonight.
Thank you, John.
This is so brilliant.
That's actor Jared Harris talking about the movie that he could watch a million times, Tootsie. This December, Harris will star as General Ulysses S. Grant in Steven Spielberg's biopic, Lincoln. Harris is best known for his role as Lane Price on the TV drama Mad Men. The show's fifth season ends tomorrow night on AMC. And it's time now for music, and this is quite possibly the song of the summer. I threw a wish in the well. The singer is 26-year-old Carly Rae Jepsen. The song is called Call Me Maybe. Does everyone who meets you think it's really, like, clever to give you their number?
It's happened a few times, yes, and they usually think that they're the first person to do it.
But what do they say to you?
Hey, I just met you, and this is crazy. But here's my number. I'm like, wow.
A year ago, Carly Rae Jepsen had a respectable music career in Canada. She'd been on stage there since age 7. She got her big break a few years ago after appearing on Canadian Idol. But today, her single, Call Me Maybe, is a monster summer pop hit. Number 1 on iTunes and number 2 on the Billboard charts. And this one song has helped her get a huge record deal. But the phenomenon behind the song may be even bigger. It spawned a host of fan-made music videos by everyone from the Harvard baseball team to Justin Bieber to actor James Franco to the Commander-in-Chief himself.
Hey, I just met you, and this is crazy, but here's my number, so call me maybe.
This version, of course, was edited from the president's speeches. Carly Rae Jepsen is barely keeping up with it all. She's taking off on a national concert tour later this year. She was in the studio this past week with Dallas Austin. He's a producer who's worked with Michael Jackson and Madonna. And when she sat down with us, I asked her how it all started.
It began, I think, with Justin's support. Justin Bieber came home for Christmas in Canada. And it was at that exact moment that Call Me Maybe was getting some radio play. And he heard the song and just kind of innocently enough tweeted that he liked it and thought it was one of the catchiest songs he'd heard. Your stare was holding, ripped jeans, skin was showing. And that's just sort of sparked a fire. Where you think you're going, baby? Hey, I just met you. And all of a sudden, people in Germany that I'd never met before were tweeting back to me saying how much they liked the song too. And then we were kind of off to the races. That was totally the game changer, and not just Justin, but that video kind of sparked these new sort of different online celebrities.
Yeah, I mean, you have Justin Bieber and Selena Gomez did a version of it. Katy Perry, actor James Franco.
Yes, and I mean,
Miley Cyrus.
It's crazy. I mean, Barack Obama.
Barack Obama's done a mashup. The Miami Dolphins cheerleaders, the Harvard baseball team. There's a player from the New York Mets, Justin Turner, who uses this song as his at-bat song.
Really?
At home games, yeah.
That's amazing.
Been covered by the band Fun, who also have had a number one hit. I mean, it is crazy. I mean, it is crazy.
Yes, it really, really is. You took your time with the call. I took no time with the fall.
You gave me nothing at all, but still you're in my way. So tell me about the guy that the song is about.
His name is Jordy. He's just my boyfriend, and he's an architect student, so kind of different world. We kind of like to keep his world a little bit more private than mine, but he's an amazing guy, and I feel very, very lucky to be with him.
I mean, so lucky that you wrote this lyric before you came into my life. I missed you so bad.
Yeah, it's exactly how I felt. As soon as he came into my life, I was like, you're the man that I missed.
That's a perfect line. I sing it all the time to my kids.
Do you?
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah. Because I really missed them before they came into my life.
Exactly. If it's possible to do so, I think we're on the same page.
Yeah. I actually read that you don't have a TV, and that you and your boyfriend, you play a lot of chess at home.
We do, yeah. It's kind of our breakfast routine. And the TV decision just didn't actually end up happening because my roommate, who was living with me at the time, moved out, and she took the television with her, and I never really replaced it, and found that I enjoyed having time to read and write songs. I think Call Me Maybe probably wouldn't have happened had I had a television.
Where was the strangest? I mean, has there been a moment in recent months where you've heard the song and you thought, this is crazy?
Yes, definitely. I this is going to be kind of strange to say on radio, but Dallas Austin, on the finishing night of our celebratory writing thing, we went to the strip club, believe it or not, and some girls got down and dirty to Call Me Maybe.
Carly Rae, who knew?
It was hilarious and awesome. And then they came and started asking for, like, autographs for their daughters. It's like, this is the weirdest signing I've ever done.
I got you. Yeah, right. Okay. You're touring with Justin Bieber later this year.
Yes, I'm so excited about that.
No pressure there, right?
I mean, definitely. I'm looking forward to putting together sort of the show of my dreams. It's the first time that I can actually, you know, think about dancers and lighting and the outfits and really get to put these sort of dreams to reality. It's going to be a ball.
Well, that's Carly Rae Jepsen. She's touring across the country this summer and later this year with Justin Bieber. Her song, Call Me Maybe, is number one on the iTunes charts and number two on the Billboard charts. Carly Rae Jepsen, good luck with the song, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Now, we mentioned all the different videos and tributes to this song online, so we here at NPR thought we couldn't miss our opportunity to contribute, so here's a taste with some familiar NPR voices.
Before you came into my life, I missed you so bad.
I missed you so bad.
I missed you so, so bad.
Tell me if I'm doing it right.
Okay.
Okay. I haven't heard this song. I should, right?
I know she's Canadian.
It's hard to look right at you, baby.
But here's my number. So call me, maybe.
Hey, I just met you.
The full version featuring Robert Siegel, Nina Totenberg, Scott Simon, Susan Stamberg, and many, many others is at our website, npr.org. For the week ending June 10th, 2012, that's the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered. Our program is directed by Phil Harrell and Lauren Silverman this week. Daniel Shukin is our engineer. Our production staff includes Brent Bachman, Lily Percy, Amy Held, Becky Sullivan, and Beenish Ahmed. Our intern is Michael Tomsik. Mathoni Maturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Guy Raz. We're back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.